Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today we are going to be looking at Boadicea. That's myself, Sven Longshanks, and Max Mussum discussing Boadicea and her famous speech. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, here we go with Boadicea. Well, as I said, we're going to get into another one of our greatest Britons here, and the greatest Briton this week is going to be Boadicea. Last week I talked about the two aviators, the two female aviators, when you weren't here, Max, and I mentioned during that I see women with lots of children as being heroines, but that's not entirely fair of me to say that, because we have had warrior queens in the past. We also had Ethelfled as well in Mercia, but the greatest one of our warrior queens was Boadicea. And rather than going to Wikipedia to get some notes on this and then quoting them and discussing them, I've actually got a very good book on history that was written in 1857. The author was called R.W. Morgan, and the book was called The British Cymry or Britons of Cambria, Outlines of Their History and Institutions from the Earliest to the Present Times, primary source edition. And it's available at archive.org. It's a fantastic book. It's a very, very patriotic book, and it uses Welsh sources, Roman sources, Greek sources, and it really does tell the story of Boadicea well. And I've got a couple of bits that we can contrast it with the way that Wikipedia tells it as well, because R.W. Morgan comes to different conclusions from similar evidence to the conclusions that Wikipedia come to. And also it contains the full speech of Boadicea, which is a fantastic, rousing nationalist speech. So I'm really, really looking forward to getting into this one. I believe you are familiar with Norfolk, Max, and this is the sort of area where Boadicea was. I mean, is she still noted there? Is she still spoken about? Are there statues of her? Is it one of the things that Norfolk is most proud of, having Queen Boadicea there at all?
I haven't seen any statues of Boadicea personally, but there is quite a celebration in various parts of Norfolk of the Iceni, who were the tribe that she was the queen of. And so there are a number of places, a number of centres, a number of buildings that are named after the Iceni. And there is a preserved Iron Age village of the Iceni that you can go and visit in Norfolk as well.
Oh, that's really good. That's really good. Because we did have these different tribes at the time. This was before the Saxons came. It was actually in AD 60. So I'll begin with the quotes here. In AD 60, the Boadicean War in the east of Britain was added to that which raged in the west under Arviragus. And that's because it was basically a war with the Romans. And that war actually went on for 40 years. I mean, this was a long war. The Britons were a fierce, formidable foe, basically. There had been two Roman invasions before them, both by Caesar, and in both of them, the Romans lost. So this was really the third time that Rome had attempted to subdue Britain. And this war actually went on for 40 years, but this was a big highlight of it, was the Boadicean Revolt. The cause of it was as follows. Sir Nietzsche, the usurer, had, without due notice given, demanded immediate repayment of his loan to the Iceni, with interest charged at an exorbitant rate. On the Icenic Senate demurring to the rate of interest and requesting time to realise the necessary funds to discharge the principal, orders at the instigation of Seneca were sent by Nero to the Roman prefect to take possession of all the public temples, castles and palaces belonging to the state. And this is interesting because the British people, they didn't get involved in usury. We didn't engage in usury. And this was quite a new thing. And this Sir Nietzsche, he was quite desperate to make this money out of the Iceni, basically. And because he wasn't paid back quickly enough, he got Nero to tell the Romans to just take possession of everything. The order was rigorously executed. A Roman force was marched upon Castor near Norwich and the garrisons placed in the inferior fortresses. A few months subsequent to these peremptory measures, and while the Iceni were still smarting under the sense of degradation, Prasutagus the king had died, leaving by his will Nero as co-heir with his two daughters to his accumulation of treasures. And it says there about the Iceni smarting under the sense of degradation. That's because the Iceni had made a peace treaty with Rome. They had agreed to pay the tribute, and in exchange for the tribute, they were supposed to be given control of their lands, given sovereignty, basically. But they were looked upon as traitors by the other tribes in Britain because they had done this. On the pretext that the whole of this royal hoard came under the denomination of public property, Caius Decius proceeded to take possession of it. Resistance being made, the legionaries stormed the palace, perpetrating the most brutal outrages on the persons of Queen Boadicea and her two daughters before carrying off the treasures to the castle. Not content with the commission of these atrocities, Decius issued an edict confiscating, in direct violation of the Claudian Treaty, the estates of many of the Icenic nobility. At the same time as the orders had been dispatched to Decius, Suetonius Paulus, who was stationed at St. Albans, received instructions to extirpate Druidism at all hazards with the sword, and with this view to invade Mona in Anglesey, its chief seat in Cambria. And that was basically the Welsh University. It was the centre of Druidism. It was the central university that they had that was in Anglesey. So at the same time that this was happening, the taking over of the Icenic property, the Romans were heading off to Anglesey to slaughter all the Druids. And I'll just stop there, Max, for your comments on that.
Sets the scene very well for us, really. I believe, as far as Seneca is concerned, he forced the loan upon the Iceni, and the loan was supposed to be 40 million sesterces. And having forced the loan on them, he would then be able to charge a rate of interest. And this was one of the ways in which usury was used as a weapon against people, by forcing a loan upon them that they were then not able to repay without there being penalties for repayment early, and then to apply a rate of interest that would ensure that the debt would grow and grow, and that the person who owed the debt would never be able to pay it back.
Yes, it was deliberately done. I mean, it was a deliberate setup. The Iceni didn't need the money anyway. They had their own holdings. They had their own land, but they had settled into paying this tribute, and they were basically they'd upset these other tribes, and they were pretty much forced into accepting this loan in the first place, and then they couldn't pay it back. Well, the attack on the Druids began, the spirit of unbending patriotism, which has in all ages and against all invaders so nobly distinguished the Bardic Order of Britain, was an unpardonable crime in the eyes of an empire whose insatiable lust for territorial aggrandizement calumniated where it could not conquer, and only spared where it could safely despise. The instructions were executed with the ruthless thoroughness characteristic of the Roman service. By a succession of forced marches, Suetonius reached the Straits of the Minae. Here, on either side, extended the cemeteries of the ancient religion. Here repose between the soaring ramparts of Snowdon and the blue waves of an unexplored and boundless sea, on the furthest verge of the old world, chiefs whose ashes for 1,500 years had never been desecrated by the tramp above them of a foreign foe, archdruids, the depositaries of the unwritten wisdom of the East, and kings whose Cymric names had carried terror to southern and far distant lands. And I'll just stop there. I mean, that gives us an idea of the pedigree of Britain. And for 1,500 years, the Druids had been going. There was 1,500 years of history that most British people today aren't aware of. They think that before the Romans came, you know, we were like savages or barbarians. But we had roads, we had cities, We had 40 different universities in Britain, according to Caesar, and all the nobility from Gaul would come over here to be educated. And as I said, we defeated Rome the first couple of times when Caesar tried to take over. I mean, Britain was a really formidable foe, and this was a real centre of it. This was the religious centre. This was where all the important people were buried. This is where our ancestors were buried, and Rome had just decided to destroy the place, basically. Through these sanctuaries of so many and such ancient memories, the regulated march of the mailed legions of Rome now resounded. But behind them, a nation was rising in arms. Whilst Druidic priests and priestess were being butchered on their own altars by the Roman sword, and the waters of the Minae were illuminated night and day by the glare of the conflagration of the sacred groves, tens of thousands of Roman citizens were expiating with their lives the nefarious massacre. No sooner had the first intimation of the real nature of the expedition of Paulinus been made known than the war became a religious crusade. So it wasn't just the defiling of Boadicea, it was the desecration of the Druidic sanctuary that really got the backs up of the British here. Do you know, have you heard about this attack on Anglesey, this attack on Mona before, Max?
No, actually, I wasn't aware of it until today. But, you know, the words that you've just been reading out to us there are very, very descriptive and set the scene really, really well. And we can see why the Iceni and the other tribes, the ancient Britons, why they were so angered by what was taking place, and why they felt it was necessary for them to revolt against Roman domination.
And it was you know, it was pretty barbaric as well what they actually ended up doing to the Romans. But the Iceni and the Corinidae had so entirely forfeited the name of Britons that their oppression alone would have been regarded in the light of a just retribution. But the massacre of the Minae merged this feeling into one of universal indignation and horror. And that's because, as I said, the Iceni had capitulated to Rome, and also this other tribe called the Corinidae. So the rest of Britain, if it had just been this attack on Boadicea, maybe they wouldn't have been, you know, they wouldn't have actually got any support. But because of this destruction of the Druidic temples, the Britons were furious. Offers of support poured in from all quarters, and Boadicea soon found herself at the head of 120,000 men. The Roman accounts impress us vividly with the deep gloom in which the Roman forces were plunged by a series of portents, all the more interesting as they are recorded in full faith by the pen of the philosophic historian Tacitus, who in the preceding page reproaches the Druidic religion as a sanguinary superstition. At Colchester, the statue of victory, like that of Dagon at Joppa, fell backwards and was broken into fragments. A pythoness, as agitated as Cassandra on the eve of the fall of Troy, with the irrepressible spirit of divination, caused the streets to re-echo with her involuntary cry, "Death is at hand." In the Roman Senate House, the British war cry, uttered by invisible tongues, terrified and dispersed the councillors. The theatres resounded with the groans and wailings of a field of battle. In the waters of the Thames appeared the mirage of a Roman colony, subverted and in ruins. The channel between Dover and Calais ran at high tide with blood, and on the tide receding, the sands revealed in long lines the impressions of files of bodies, as if laid out for burial. And remember, Tacitus, just before writing this, had been reproaching the Druids for superstitions. And then he writes this about everything that the Romans saw. The Minae massacre had in fact no less terrified the conscience of its perpetrators than it had roused beyond control the religious fury of the British population. The deity, states Dion Cassius, predicted by these and other omens the magnitude of the impending disasters. The war was marked indeed by all the atrocities on both sides, which have ever been the characteristic of religious crusades. And all that was new to me. I didn't realise that, you know, they had actually had all these omens.
This is the sort of thing that somebody ought to make a...
Yeah.
There ought to be a full feature film made of this story, shouldn't there, don't you think?
Definitely, definitely. Boadicea's prayer, we've got next. The British army assembled at Carlisle, Leicester, under Venusius, and was harangued in person by Boudicca. The description of the person of the outraged queen by Dion is exceedingly interesting. Boadicea mounted the general's tribunal. Her stature was of the largest, her appearance terrible, her aspect calm and collected, her voice deep and stern. Her hair fell as low as the hips in long golden tresses, collected around her forehead by a golden coronet. She wore a tartan dress, fitting closely to the bosom, but below the waist opening in loose folds as a gown. Over it was a chlamys, or military cloak. This was her usual attire, but on this occasion she also carried a spear. And, you know, that's how I imagine her seeing. So that description there must have been sort of held to, because when you imagine seeing, you know, in your mind's eye of what Boadicea looks like, I imagine her looking like that. And in the statue that they did of her, they actually did, on her chariot, they had scythes coming out from the wheels. And I noted that in the Wikipedia report of this, they said, oh, that was an anachronism, that there were scythes on the wheels like the ones in Persia. But in actual fact, Caesar writes about that, about the Britons being in chariots with scythes on the wheels, and the scythes on the wheels actually go back to Troy. It's actually more evidence to the early tales of the Britons actually coming from Troy, because these chariots with these scythes on them, Rome didn't have them, and they had stopped having them in Persia for quite some time. But where Britain was outside of the Roman Empire, we still had them. And it also tells us, because we had these chariots, that we also had a system of roads, proper roads, not muddy tracks. I mean, you can't have a horse and chariot on a muddy track. You have to have proper stones there, a proper surface to actually travel along. Have you heard of this description before, Max? What do you think of this? Wearing a tartan dress and the golden coronet on her forehead.
Yeah, I think she sounds very dramatic and formidable. I would think that she would be very charismatic as a queen. You asked me actually earlier, and it didn't occur to me at the time, but there is a statue of Boadicea in Great Yarmouth. I mentioned in an earlier episode of this program, Air in Britannia, that when we spoke about Lord Nelson, I mentioned that there was a monument to Lord Nelson in Great Yarmouth. And that monument, although it is a monument to Lord Nelson, at the very top of the tower, instead of it being a statue of Nelson, is a statue of Boadicea.
And also the name Boadicea, it's as you say, it means victory. And Victoria, Queen Victoria herself, was named after Boadicea. And you were mentioned in the Victorian times is really when this story got told a lot, and they made a lot of it. But the actual recordings of it go right back to shortly after the time that it happened. So we know that these descriptions are accurate. One of them, I think, was written at the time, and the other one was written about 50 years after, something like that. So these are accurate descriptions. Her prayer to Andraste, the British goddess of victory, will give a fair idea of the spirit and tenor of her address. I thank thee, I worship thee, I appeal to thee, a woman to a woman, O Andraste. I rule not like Nitocris over beasts of burden, as are the effeminate nations of the East, nor like Semiramis over mere tradesmen and traffickers like the Egyptians, nor like the man-woman Nero over slaves and eunuchs. Such is the precious literature these Romans would introduce among us. But I rule over Britons, little skilled indeed in craft and policy, but born and trained to the game of war. Men who in the cause of liberty stake down their own lives, the lives of their wives and children, their lands and property. Queen of such a race, I implore thine aid for freedom, for victory over enemies infamous for the wantonness of the wrongs they inflict, for their perversion of justice, for their contempt of religion, for their insatiable greed, and a people also that revel in unmanly pleasures, that cannot live without luxurious dishes, or sleep except on beds of down, whose affections are more to be dreaded and abhorred than their wars. Never let a foreigner bear rule over me or these my countrymen. Never let slavery reign in this isle. Its proper home is Rome. Be thou alone forever, O goddess of manhood and of victory, sovereign and queen in Britain. And that's a great speech there. And there is loads in that that we could get into. I didn't want to actually stop at each bit because I wanted to get the whole feel of it across. But going back to what she was saying, what she was saying there, the effeminate nations of the East, Nitocris, who rules over the beasts of burden, and Semiramis, who rules over tradesmen and traffickers like the Egyptians, and then the man-woman Nero, and then talking about the Romans introducing literature, which encourages this stuff. Now, how relevant to that is today? This, you know, this effeminate encouragement of men to be like women, and the corrupting literature that we have, and it all, and also this, you know, introducing foreigners and foreign rule over the British people. I mean, I was really struck with how similar that is to what's going on today. What do you make of that, Max?
Yeah, I think that analogy fits very well. I think perhaps it's it may have been, since the beginning of time, a tactic on the part of monolithic empires who want to suffer a far-flung part of their empire to introduce all forms of perversion and
effeminacy
in order to make the population of that province soft, that's right, and easy to dominate.
Yes, this idea of accusing your enemies of being effeminate, this was the worst insult that could be laid at the feet of anyone at the time. It's also in Josephus and his histories of Judea. That's a great insult in there. And this Nero, I mean, he was absolutely crazy. And, you know, he could hardly inspire his army to actually fight for him. There was one instance where he actually bottled out of attacking Britain and got his men to collect seashores from the beach while putting seaweed over his head. And he made this speech about, we'll just take these shells as the beauties of nature rather than wasting lives by going over and fighting against the barbaric Britons or words, you know, similar to that. Nero was quite well known as this crazy guy. I think he actually had a Jewish mistress as well, who was the one that it was encouraging him to persecute the Christians, because at this time you just had we'd had the crucifixion, and the apostles were sort of making their way out from Judea and Rome, and there was persecution of them at the time, because it was shortly after this that Christianity really took off in Britain. Maybe that had something to do with all the Druid sanctuaries being destroyed. I don't know, because I have read that the Druids were quite friendly to the apostles and to the early Christians. But this insult of them being effeminate, I mean, if you look at today, men are just being encouraged all the time to be effeminate. And the ways that we're being subverted is through the literature and through the mainstream media. And the Romans were doing exactly the same. And you think what they had actually done to Boadicea, or to her daughters, this horrific rape. I think they actually whipped Boadicea herself. Yeah. I mean, this is a huge insult to the British people to do this to their queen. And because of all this, you know, the way that we've been encouraged with this effeminacy, you think, you know, we've had 1,400 white girls that were raped by the grooming gangs, you know, more than that. And there really hasn't been any pushback against it, because we've all succumbed to this effeminate literature, what it calls it here. And you think this was just, you know, the defiling of two women, basically, and one of them was whipped. And there was this huge, huge revolt. Well, the revolt begins. Colchester was carried on the first assault by the British army. The temple garrisoned by the veterans held out for 2 days and then shared the same fate. Petilius Cerealis, the Roman lieutenant, was defeated with the loss of the whole of the 9th Legion at Cogia Hall. That's Cocky Collis. Cerealis himself, with a few horsemen, escaped into camp. The municipal town of Verulam was in the same manner stormed, gutted, and burned. And I've got the first quote here from Wikipedia, which goes into more detail of the sacking of Colchester. Tacitus mentions long-standing reasons for the Trinovantes to hate Rome. The Trinovantes were another tribe that joined the Iceni. It was against the veterans that their hatred was most intense. For these new settlers in the colony of Camalodunum drove people out of their houses, ejected them from their farms, called them captives and slaves. And again, that reminded me of people being turfed out of their council houses so they can put Syrian refugees in there, and 60% of London being non-white. And you had a similar thing happening here with the Romans that were replacing the Trinovantes, who were actually in Colchester, and originally they were in London, because Trinovante means New Troy, and London was originally New Troy, so they must have moved up to Colchester from London. The rebels' first target was Camalodunum, modern Colchester, the former Trinovantian capital, and at that time, a Roman colony. The Roman veterans who had been settled there had mistreated the locals, and a temple to the former Emperor Claudius had been erected there at local expense, making the city a focus for resentment. The Roman inhabitants sought reinforcements from the procurator, Catus Decianus, but he sent only 200 auxiliary troops. Boudicca's army fell on the poorly defended city and destroyed it, besieging the last defenders in the temple for 2 days before it fell. A bronze statue to the Emperor Nero, which probably stood in front of the temple, was decapitated and its head taken as a trophy by Boudicca's army. Archaeologists have shown that the city was methodically demolished. The future governor Quintus Petilius Cerealis, then commanding the 9th Legion, attempted to relieve the city, but suffered an overwhelming defeat. The infantry with him were all killed. Only the commander and some of his cavalry escaped. The victorious enemy met Petius Cerealis, commander of the 9th Legion, as he was coming to the rescue, routed his troops, and destroyed all his infantry. Cerealis escaped with some cavalry into the camp and was saved by its fortifications. The location of this battle is unknown, but has been claimed by some modern localities. After this defeat, Catius Decianus fled to Gaul. Do you know anything about that one, Max? The sacking of Colchester? Is that talked about there?
I don't know Colchester very well, and I don't have any sort of specific information about the sacking of Colchester, apart from just a comment that for the Roman legions to be defeated in the way that they were here would have taken a tremendous amount of military tactical prowess and strategic prowess. You know, the Roman legions were renowned for their ability to take on opposing forces of greater numbers and to prevail over those greater forces. The troops were all very well equipped with armor. Were all very well equipped with those large rectangular shields, and they could form a phalanx that would then make them virtually impermeable to attacks by using arrows or spears from their enemies. And for the British tribal armies, which is effectively what they were, for them to be able to take on the Romans and beat them would have been a very considerable feat that they would have undoubtedly celebrated very widely and very enthusiastically afterwards.
They were a formidable foe. We're getting back to the destruction of London now, and this is R.W. Morgan, his account again. London, during the protracted absence of Arviragus in the west, that was the king that was making war on the Romans in the west, had once again failed in its allegiance and received a Roman garrison under the name of a colony within its walls. Its commerce at this period was so extensive that the Roman citizens alone resident in it were estimated at 50,000. If we calculate these at so high as a sixth part of its whole population, we have a strong, although undesigned, confirmation of the extreme antiquity assigned by the British historians to the foundation and splendour of the British capital. Against it, the British army, now swelled to 230,000 men, directed its vengeance. Such of the inhabitants as possessed the means fled at its approach. The rest, including the Roman citizens and foreign merchants, took refuge with the garrison in the ramparts extending from the Temple of Diana to the White Mount. The ramparts were escaladed, the city fired in four different quarters, public buildings and private residences reduced alike to ashes. No quarter or ransom, states Tacitus, was given or taken on either side in this war. It is difficult to conjecture how many lives were sacrificed in this act of national justice. Tacitus implies that before the engagement with Paulinus, more than 70,000 Romans had fallen, either in garrison or in the field. It is worthy of remark that the only time London has been rifled and destroyed has been not by a foreign enemy, but by a British queen and a British army, visiting it with condign punishment for its collusion with a foreign invader. The lesson appears never to have been forgotten, for its citizens have ever since been the first to repel the open attacks or insidious influences of foreign powers, leaving this terrible example of a metropolis smouldering in ashes, quenched with the blood of its inhabitants behind. Boadicea swept westwards with her forces. Tacitus records but two engagements, Dion Meni, between her and the Roman general. Her epithet in the British chronicles, Verdig or Victoria, implies that in not a few of these, successes attended her arms. So they totally destroyed London.
Yeah.
Completely. I've got a Wikipedia account of this as well. When news of the rebellion reached Suetonius, he hurried along Watling Street through hostile territory to Londinium. Londinium was a relatively new settlement founded after the conquest of AD 43, but it had grown to be a thriving commercial centre with a population of traders and probably Roman officials. Suetonius considered giving battle there, but considering his lack of numbers and chastened by Petilius's defeat, decided to sacrifice the city to save the province. And this is a quote from Tacitus. Alarmed by this disaster and by the fury of the province which he had goaded into war by his rapacity, the procurator Catus crossed over into Gaul. Suetonius, however, with wonderful resolution, marched amidst a hostile population to Londinium, which, though undistinguished by the name of a colony, was much frequented by a number of merchants and trading vessels. Uncertain whether he should choose it as a seat of war, as he looked around on his scanty force of soldiers and remembered with what a serious warning the rashness of Petilius had been punished, he resolved to save the province at the cost of a single town. Nor did the tears and weeping of the people, as they implored his aid, deter him from giving the signal of departure and receiving into his army all who would go with him. Those who were chained to the spot by the weakness of their sex, or the infirmity of age, or the attractions of the place, were cut off by the enemy. And then back to Wikipedia's summary. Londinium was abandoned to the rebels, who burnt it down, torturing and killing anyone who had not evacuated with Suetonius. Archaeology shows a thick red layer of burnt debris, covering coins and pottery dating before AD 60, within the bounds of Roman Londinium, while Roman-era skulls found in the Walbrook in 2013 may have been victims of the rebels. Verulamium, or St. Albans, was next to be destroyed. In the three settlements destroyed, between 70 and 80,000 people are said to have been killed. Tacitus says that the Britons had no interest in taking or selling prisoners, only in slaughter by gibbet, fire, or cross. Dio's account gives more detail, that the noblest women were impaled on spikes and had their breasts cut off and sewn to their mouths, to the accompaniment of sacrifices, banquets, and wanton behaviour in sacred places, particularly the groves of Andraste. I mean, that sounds pretty savage, but then you think of what the Romans had done to the Britons' holy places and to their queen. And the other bit I wanted to point out about that was the way that Wikipedia says that London was founded after the conquest of AD 43, but had grown to be a thriving commercial centre. That's contradicted by what R.W. Morgan is saying because of the number of people. Because of the number of people, it shows that that London had been there for centuries. But the narrative today is to pretend that it was the Romans that did it all. Do you see what I mean there, where he's saying about them, you know, it was founded in AD 43, with a population of traders? Because to whoever was writing that, it's impossible for the Britons to actually have a population of traders of their own and already have a capital city. And then finally, I've got R.W. Morgan's report of the final battle. Tacitus fixes the last battle on the edge of Epping Forest, as do the Greek historian and the British traditions, on the Guadalian Road near Newmarket in Flintshire. The various names on this latter site express so correctly the incidents of the battle that we may almost imagine Dion Cassius examined the ground before writing his description. Here are Cop Paulinius, the Hill of Arrows, the Hill of Carnage, the Hollow of Woe, the Knoll of the Melee, the Hollow of Execution, the Field of the Tribunal, and the Hollow of No Quarter. So they're all names that are still there on the Ordnance Survey maps, and there are a lot of places in Wales that still have names related to these battles. So it's more evidence to say that this all happened, basically. Half a mile distant is the memorial stone, termed the Stone of Lamentation, and on the road to Carwis was formerly, but now removed to Downing, the Stone of the Grave of Budig, Victoria's tomb. Turning to the pages of Dion, we find the conflict to have been just what these names suggest and perpetuate. A deadly melee of heavy armed legionaries, auxiliaries, archers, cavalry and charioteers mingled together and swaying to and fro in the heady currents of a desperate fight over the whole extent of the ground. But the fortune of the day towards sunset inclined towards the Romans. The Britons were driven back within their entrenchments, leaving a large number dead on the field or prisoners in the hands of the enemy. The rest retired in good order and prepared shortly after to renew the conflict. In the interim, however, Victoria died, according to Tacitus, by poison, according to Dion, in the course of nature. She was buried with profuse magnificence. I mean, that's a magnificent tale, I think, the it history is. Of the Britons. You know, we got that flowing in our blood. That you know, that archetype, and particularly the women. You know, our women have that archetype within them to turn into a hellion like that and inspire the army to go out and fight against the foreign invaders. It's a lot of the stuff that was written back then around 1860. It's so patriotic. I mean, all the stuff that I read from that time has that sort of patriotic flavour to it. And the Brits were so proud of having the British Empire and proud of their achievements. And this was all taught in history lessons, you know, the history of Britain, because it does go back that far. We used to have a book called The Brute or The Chronicles of England that goes right the way back to Brutus, the Prince of Troy, that first colonised Britain. And that was actually the second best-selling book after the Bible. For hundreds
it's
of
often
years.
It's often very informative if you get the opportunity to have a look through an old secondhand bookshop that's got books in it that were written more than say 100 years ago. And to compare, as you say, the writing style of people in those days with the writing style of history books that have been written more recently, and it becomes crystal clear when you do that that there has been a marked shift in the mental approach of the historians of today compared with the historians of the past, where the historians of the past were trying to put together a cogent story of our nation and our people going back into the past, so that people reading their histories would have a sense of history, would have a sense of tradition, would have a sense that they are connected by blood and by spirit with the people that existed in the generations past, whereas all of that has now gone, and what we have are very insipid histories. And whereas the histories of the past would have focused on the sort of thing we've been looking at here this afternoon, which is the struggle of the Iceni and the British tribes to free themselves of domination by the Romans. Instead of having heroic stories of that sort that are intended to inspire the current generations to go on and to even greater glory, what we have are histories that focus on things like that the arrangements within local housing areas for the disposal of sewage, or the way in which farmers might use various substances in the raising of their cattle and things of that sort, things which are kind of like social history, but which contain no inspiration for the people that are reading them. And I think that's a great shame. I'm not saying that there's not a place for social history. There obviously is a place for social history and the way in which towns and things developed, but that form of history really is a very lackluster element of history when compared, and a less potent form of history than the histories of yesteryear, where they try to thrill us and inspire us with our nation's story.
It's a part of the emasculating literature that the Roman Empire brought. You know, the teaching people histories that people aren't going to be interested in. When I was doing history at school, all I can remember of it is being taught about Jethro Tull's seed drill. I was never told anything exciting like this. And when you think about what people are taught about history today, they're taught to feel guilty. They're taught the bad things the British Empire did, how we've all got to feel bad and guilty for slavery. We mustn't forget that we're all taught about the Holocaust as well. We were not taught anything inspiring like this, which, as you say, Max, it was intended to spur the people reading it on to greater glories. And the word itself, history, it's his story. It was supposed to be the story of the British race. And this is what they were trying to piece together. That's what this Brute, the Chronicle of England, was. That was the History of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth, trying to tie it all in together with the Roman documents and the stuff that was recorded in Greek, and show that the British had just as much of a pedigree as Rome and Greece, and our Druidic religion was a very important one for the whole of the continent. And people just not taught it today. But yeah, that's a very, very inspirational story there. I think she was certainly one of our greatest Britons, and she's up there with Alfred the Great and Captain Cook and the others that we've gone through. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out in the future for more Greatest Britons at RadioAlbion.com.